It's only me and you.
Oh, what, is there a third guy? What happened to the third guy?
No.
I know Al Schmidt. Was there something else, though? Was there?
Mm-hmm.
No? Welcome back. I am feeding back after feeding myself. I'm pleased to have this session here, which is sponsored by the Grammy Foundation. As you know, the Grammy Foundation, in addition to working on education projects and projects to make musicians' later years nicer and health projects, does a lot of work in preservation, and of which ARSC is a beneficiary. Our cylinder group is funded by the Grammy Foundation. And I am pleased to present to you Cheryl Moliconi, who's Director of Special Projects for the Grammy Foundation. I'm gonna turn this session over to her. Thanks.
Well, thank you all for coming. We have two amazing gentlemen here today who have both been very involved with the Recording Academy for a number of years in various capacities, and I will introduce them in more depth later, but on my far left is Ralph Sutton, who is the chief engineer at Wonderland Studios, working with Stevie Wonder, largely, and next to him is Andy McKay. Andy is at Universal Music. He oversees all the reissue projects at Universal. He's been there for a number of years. And I'll tell you a little bit more about both of them in a couple of minutes. But this is a panel on preserving pop masters, as you know. But I would like to take this opportunity, if you'll indulge me for just a couple of minutes, to tell you just a little bit about what the Grammy Foundation does in terms of preservation. I know a lot of you know that we do some preservation work, but a lot of people don't know exactly what we do. So most recently, maybe some of you have heard about the National Recording Preservation Act of 2000. The Grammy Foundation actually helped to spearhead that in conjunction with SAM and the Library of Congress. And that legislation actually established an audio registry, which will be a listing of significant, historically significant recordings that require preservation. Work, and it will also contain a lot of research on how to preserve and what should be preserved and all of that. The first meeting of that group, maybe you've already heard this, so forgive me if I'm repeating, but the first meeting of that group occurred in March, the Preservation Board, and we're very excited about that, as I believe the Library of Congress is also. That comes with a little bit of money to do the work that has been already started in the film preservation community. So this is kind of a comparable legislation, and we're very pleased that that has actually gotten started. In addition, the Grammy Foundation does a project called Grammy Living Histories, which videotapes the life stories of significant people who have impacted the history of music and recording. And when I say significant, that they have contributed in a major way to the history of music and recording. This is different from a lot of other oral history projects in that it's videotaped. We've done about 150 of those over the last 2 years, and we've actually created a television program out of one of them, which is a TV show on Memphis Blues project, which has actually been aired on PBS in a couple of markets. And that's our goal. Our goal is not just to do these oral histories and put them on a shelf, although anybody is welcome to access these oral histories at any time. So there is a list of these oral histories available, and anybody who would like to access them, they're open and available for people who want to make use out of them. It covers everybody from not just artists, but also the technical engineering community that actually produces recordings, the business community that has developed the whole music and recording industry. And it's largely people talking about who they knew and what the real stories were, not just the stories that you read in books, but the real thing. So that's Grammy Living Histories. We also do a music on film preservation project where we partner with various archives around the country to preserve historic performances captured on film. We've been doing this for several years now. We've worked with archives like the Woody Guthrie Archives, the Leonard Bernstein Archives. We've worked with the Library of Congress Archives. We had a wonderful event 2 years ago where we had Coretta Scott King in person talking about her friend Leontine Price. Turns out that Coretta Scott King was an opera singer before she met Martin Luther King. She was on that path and knew Leontine and actually competed with Leontine Price for some scholarships. Lost to her, of course, but had some great stories to tell about Leontine. We had Della Reese there. We had performances. I mean, what we try to do is not just preserve the music on film, but actually make it come alive for people. So, you know, with performances and all of that as well. This year, we partnered with the Smithsonian to do a program for Jazz Appreciation Month. Many of you may know this was the first ever Jazz Appreciation Month spearheaded by the Smithsonian. We worked with the Louis Armstrong Archives, the Dave Brubeck Archives, and the Rutgers Jazz Institute to preserve works by Louis Armstrong, Dave Brubeck, and Bud Powell. And it was an amazing event. And we don't do it for the event. We do it to actually preserve the recordings, but we want to make it come alive. We want to bring that music out to people and not just preserve it and put it on a shelf somewhere. Our goal is also to send this around to our 12 chapters and branches around the country. And some of you may know we also do, as Sam mentioned, we do educational programs. We're planning to send all of these preserved materials into our Leonard Bernstein schools. We also run the Leonard Bernstein Center for Learning, which we recently acquired about 2 years ago. Alexander Bernstein is now on our board and helps us oversee the Leonard Bernstein Center for Learning, which is really a professional development program for teachers, helping them figure out ways of incorporating the arts and the creative approach of the arts to all learning across the board. So we do that, and most recently we have established a preservation studios network where we are partnering with large studios that can handle a variety of media who have agreed to help us to preserve materials that we identify at a cost basis, cost plus 5%. So they're only making 5% on this. They do this at their off times, off peak times. They're, as I say, the larger studios that can accommodate a variety of media. And so we're hoping to identify at-risk media by making these studios available to people who want to preserve their own recordings or studio recordings. So that's just a little bit. We do a lot more than that. There's actually a packet in the back room that will tell you all about the Grammy Foundation's other programs. There's also, I'll tell you now because I'll probably forget later, there are also posters in the back room for all of you. There are enough for everybody for Jazz Appreciation Month that we developed with the Smithsonian. It was distributed 100,000 posters to the American Library Association, MENC, IAJE, and a lot of NPR, National Association of State and Local Arts Agencies, to highlight Jazz Appreciation Month because, you know, it's our national music. So enough about what the Grammy Foundation does. That's just a little bit to get you acquainted with who we are and what you do if you don't know. And now I'd like to give you a little bit more formal introduction of our two gentlemen here. Again, on the far left is Ralph Sutton. I'll tell you just a little bit about Ralph. His illustrious career as a recording engineer spans the better part of three decades and innumerable sessions with the recording industry's elite. After graduating from the Recording Institute of America and taking courses at UCLA, Ralph was hired at City Recorders as a runner, that's how he started, and quickly advanced to second engineer. He subsequently moved to Chateau Recording Studios, where he collaborated with Ken Scott, the great British engineer of Beatles fame, and worked on recordings for Missing Persons, Kenny Loggins, Kansas, among others. He then moved to Electra Asylum, where he worked on Motley Crue's Shout Out the Devil, and settled down at Motown Hitsville, USA, where he began to record the R&B and funk sounds that garnered him an outstanding reputation that he still has today. He's worked on recordings featuring The Temptations, Marvin Gaye, The Four Tops, Smokey Robinson, and Rick James, and has handled pre-recorded music for the Emmys. He's partnered with Umberto Gatica and has created magic for Julio Iglesias, Chicago, Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, and Dionne Warwick, to name a few. He's worked with a few celebrities here and there. A longtime member of the Recording Academy, Ralph was recently elected to the Board of Governors, is liaison to our Producers and Engineers Wing, and chaired our Grammy in the School's host committee this year. Ralph is chief engineer at Wonderland Studios and oversees all of the recording by Stevie Wonder today. And so Ralph is going to talk to us a little bit about his original recordings, and he's very, very into preservation, so he has a lot to tell us. A little bit about Andy McKay. Andy is a 30-year veteran of the music industry. He's been with Universal for almost 19 years. He spent the last 15 years in charge of first the MCA Labels reissue program and then as Senior Vice President A&R for Universal Music Enterprises, heading a department responsible for pop, rock, and country reissues for all of the Universal Music Group labels, which is considerable. He's a busy guy. And we're very grateful that he's here today. It just so happened Andy was in Santa Barbara. We're so thrilled that he was able to come today. As a reissue producer, Andy has produced, compiled, or oversaw literally hundreds of reissues. His packages have captured 9 Grammy nominations, winning 3. Andy himself winning a pair as reissue producer of Chuck Berry, The Chess Box, and reissue co-producer of Billie Holiday, The Complete Decca Recordings. His compilations have been named Reissue of the Year in such publications as Rolling Stone, Village Voice, and CD Review, and Reissue Producer of the Year by critics in Living Blues. A dozen of his reissues have been certified gold or platinum, including the Elton John box set To Be Continued, which he produced, and Lynyrd Skynyrd, the box set, which he co-produced. And he also co-produced the Grammy Award-winning album Blues Summit, an album of newly recorded duets with Robert Cray, Etta James, John Lee Hooker, and others. Andy is probably the most knowledgeable person on the planet in terms of reissues, I would say. I know. He won't admit it, but it's true. Anyway, to get us started, I just had a couple of questions just to get us started on the whole preservation issue and how things have changed over the years in terms of the awareness of preservation at record labels. I would say, and you know, these gentlemen will tell you more about it, but probably 15 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of attention paid to preservation. A lot of materials were on shelves unmarked, badly stored, still is the case in some ways, but things have changed a little bit, and I'd like to ask both of you if you could comment on how the recording of process might have changed in recent years to reflect the growing awareness of preservation among both artists and engineers. And I'd like to start with Ralph, because Ralph is doing original recordings, and then move on to Andy in terms of reissues. Ralph?
The way that the process has changed in one of many respects is that we're being much more meticulous about the way we record the actual tracks to tape. We're going at a much higher level to tape at +9, typically when we're in the analog domain. And we're doing it with preservation in mind, opposed to when we were doing records in the 70s and 80s, where we were making records to make a stereo master and send the stereo master off to a pressing plant and forget about the multi-track master completely at that point. So now we are recording records with preservation in mind. Preservation is also part of the publishing aspect. So if you lose the master, if the master is not maintained, then your worth is only your stereo master, opposed to the actual tape itself or the mother that made the master. So in that regard, we are much more cautious, and perfection is a little more, our intent is better, I should say. So.
Well, I think the CD revolution caused the all the corporations, the companies, to realize they had assets that they had been basically ignoring or storing poorly. They were basically ignoring or storing poorly or just not cataloging properly. And a lot of the companies, I know ours, we were discussing this before, built a vault, a state-of-the-art vault in the late 80s that really turned things around for us, where we went from having things in non-air-conditioned sub-storage facilities into a temperature-controlled vault that it took a long time to get it together, but it's pretty much there. And then we merged, our company merged with PolyGram. PolyGram had a facility similar, but it's taken us a long time to sort through. It's such a huge corporation now, and some of the individual labels didn't have it together, or they were using storage facilities that were pretty sad. But everybody's pretty much aware of it and have upgraded. We use an underground facility in Pennsylvania and U.S. to store the, for most of the time, multi-tracks. And the reissue process itself, the one that I've been involved in for what seems like forever, has actually given this whole new process of storage and identifying tapes a whole new life. It really, I don't know how many tapes, and I'm speaking, some work does this on the East Coast with me, is over here, Harry Wenger. I don't have how many tapes between the two of us probably we've gone through and identified. And the way that before it was just a number that no one knew, because the number came from one of the previous labels that we don't know what that label was, why they stored it the way they stored it. And we've identified it, we know what it is, it's now accessible. Sometimes they're not even numbered, blank boxes. The problems that Ralph was talking about, it was the previous level, early recording, especially I guess in the early pop era of the second half of the 20th century, it was considered disposable music. And the whole notion was just to get it out there, sell it, and forget about it. And that, fortunately, starting in the late 80s especially, that the whole ship has been turned around. And now we're going in the right direction.
Can you tell us about some of the stories that you've encountered in the archives?
The stories. You know, it's picking up. We acquired a label at one point, and I had to go through the tapes. And it's so sad sometimes because they store them at these facilities that were not air conditioned, and you take out it, open up something, and it literally would flake off in your hands. It was terrible. You see through, print through.
Tape stored on hubs.
Excuse me.
Tape stored on hubs.
Hubs on reels, hubs, yeah, or store and wound too tight and they explode or whatever. There's so many problems. Every day for a long time. I think that's pretty much ceased to a degree because we've gone through so many of these reels, or I've have gone, especially with the MCA vault. I went through so many of the reels all the time. I don't run into too as many exploding tapes or. Some of those problems that occurred, but it was a consistent thing for years where there was everything was wrong. It was, you know, the type of they would use Scotch tape instead of the proper tape to hold it together. It was incredible. We live with the mistakes of history in every venture in life. And in the late 80s, we were living with, and into the 90s, and today too, I guess, in some instances, we're living with all the mistakes that were made by our predecessors, everyone from storage to actually the mechanics of putting the tape together and putting it away. It was truly sad. The specifics, I don't know. I mean. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we had a problem where people in the past, when I first started doing this, obviously the early history of MCA is Decca Records, and a lot of the Decca recordings were on metal and on glass and on acetate and whatever, and they would send these around in boxes, and the box would be mailed, and you'd get a piece of shatter, you got a shattered piece, you know, the master was shattered. And it was sad. We had to change all the systems because these people were not, everybody in the record industry wasn't used to any of these things up until the reissue boom of the 80s. No one was used to this. they were going off second-generation masters, you know, sitting in the vaults and making their vinyl pressings. They didn't go back to the original, so they didn't know how to handle the original. So we actually came up with guidelines on how to handle pre-tape material at our facilities and circulated them. It starts with that and works its way forward with the misuse of tape. And unfortunately, the 70s tape, for instance, is terrible. It's terrible sounding. It sticks. More often than not, you end up baking it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do as best you can to transfer it as fast as possible and get a good transfer, because mm-hmm. you don't know how many times you can use it thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the 50s tape is marvelous, generally. The 50s tape that I inherited from, that we've inherited from Decca and Mercury, is just sensational. So it's variable. It's greatly variable from instance to instance.
And then there's a story of one record label, which is not yours, but another major record label that just did wholesale dumping of tape in the 70s.
Well, actually, one of the labels we own.
Oh, it is one? I guess you own half the catalog now.
We own a lot of the catalog. One of the labels that we own was ABC. When we were trying to find different things, I would go through these tapes and I would find destroy orders. They would literally, and I asked a bunch of people, and they were storing at Beacons in Los Angeles. And they would run out of storage space. They would run out of storage space in Beacons, and so they didn't want to take any more space. So they would figure out what to destroy. And I was told at one point, if they had a stereo version of it, they got rid of the mono. That was one of the criteria. But I've seen multi-tracks that were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It was cheapness and short-sightedness.
There were many session tapes, apparently.
Session tapes.
Session tapes destroyed.
Yeah.
All the history of, you know, the things that everybody's really interested in today.
Well, Atlantic had the fire, but that wasn't their fault. Atlantic had a fire and lost the masters, but that wasn't their fault, as opposed to ABC, who intentionally destroyed their own assets.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the original, since you're involved in the original recording mm-hmm. process, and you've been doing this for quite a while now, about how the consciousness of preservation may impact how you record things and what happens to material once it's done, and what conversations you might have with artists about how to deal with their recordings. And.
Mm-hmm. Well, much like I said in the beginning, what we do is we try to get as much level on tape as possible, which now, because the manufacturers of tape, Quantigy and MTEC, have come up with a formula that allows us now to get +9 level on tape, that's 520 nanowebers at +9. What that does is that eliminates a lot of the hiss that we used to get, or what we would consider the just tape noise in general. But before I go any further, here's a tape that's interesting. This is artist Stanley Clark, that I got this tape at a garage sale. And I bought all 8 of them. And I happened to notice that the very first song is I Want to Play for You, which was a big hit record for this guy. This is the safety copy, and this tape actually has some water damage. And it is playable. It does not need to be baked. There's no fungus growing on it. But that kind of chimes into what he was just saying, and that is that sometimes I think that people, we forget, or the public in general, and sometimes the public is actually a record company executive or somebody of that nature, who they think that this is, once it's been put onto a CD or into the cassette format or something along that line for mass distribution and sale, that that is actually it and they're done with it. And here it is. This is a safety. This is a real deal safety here. This is what they were depending on in the event that the masters were lost. And like I said, I got this at a garage sale and it was sitting on the front line of these people's house. And I purchased it. So
send it to the Grammy Preservation Studios Network. We might be able to
there. You have it. With I'll use Stevie Wonder as a good example, who's very interested in preservation and also making sure that his records will be played long after he has passed on, which all of us will do at some point. So one of the things that he's concerned with, and right now we have archiving process that's going on now, where Stevie actually has tapes from 1962. And he keeps those tapes in a number of different vaults that have all been created for the storage of film and tape. And we make sure, I've gone to some of the vaults, not all of them, and I've made sure that the tapes are stored on end, which would be like this. And just to make sure that the climate control was correct in it, and it is. He's fortunate enough to be able to afford to use designated buildings for that, not beacons or, you know, something along that line. Typically what I do when I do archive one of his tapes or something that he's interested in listening back to, and I bring it to his attention that the tape looks like it potentially is in danger, I do what I've named a double redundant, where I take the original master, and I always handle the original master with one thing in mind, and that is that I only get one play. Even though the tape may not be in bad shape, I always look at it like that I have one shot at it. So typically what I'll do with the tape that he may have recorded in the early 70s or late 60s is I will set up the either the two-track machine or the multi-track machine at a standard level, the plus three standard, regardless to whether or not there are tones on the tape or not, because I don't even exercise the tape. Basically, I set the machine up, I degauss it, do all the things that are necessary to make sure that the tape will be played at its optimal. I put that tape on, I set up another analog machine, and I set up one of our Sony 3348 multi-track machines also. And I hit play and record on both of those machines. I let them run for about 15 seconds, and then I hit play on the machine that is holding the actual master. I do not stop that master. If there's a snap, a pop, or anything like that, or a dropout, I let it continue on to the very end, and I take it off. I let that tape play onto the take-up reel, and I do not mess with it. I don't rewind it. I don't do anything like that to it. I put the tape back in its box, and I make sure that we get it back to the facility that we're storing it in. The reason why I do the double redundant is analog tape, even though we've come up with all these magnificent digital medias, I know for fact that this analog tape will play 35 to 40 years from now if stored properly. It may not have the greatest high frequency. It may not be the way it sounded when we did it initially, but we know that we will be able to get some semblance of what the producer and the artist's intent was. Then we can transfer it into the digital domain, into Pro Tools or one of the other digital audio workstations, and we can synthetically recreate what it was that the artist had in mind. If we're lucky, we will have the artist and the producer present, and we go at it from there. If they're not present, depending upon the nature of the product, if it's something that lends to creativity from my aspect as an engineer, then I will make it meet the market palette, or what I believe is going to sell in today's market. If it's something that is supposed to be preserved and reproduced in its original form, then I do everything to a standard that does not allow me to do any EQing, effects, compression, or anything of that nature. So it's really dependent upon what we're trying to accomplish when we're doing a archival reproduction. So,
Andy, maybe you can tell us about what you think about when you're doing your reissues and how you do that.
Oh, well, as far as the technical end of it is, Ralph has more than covered that. I actually thought of the the yard sale tape, a bit of a story, actually. We had we went to do a reissues of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' first two albums that were recorded for Shelter in Tulsa. And we couldn't find the masters. Found seconds, but not the masters. And so, like, it was talked about the internet. You know, these things get on the internet and spread like wildfire, the word. And this is over a decade ago, so the internet was at its early stage. But it's still, someone found it, got word back to someone in Oklahoma, who called up Tom's manager and said, "I've got the masters." He said, "Well, how did you get the masters?" And he said, "When they closed down the studios, the Shelter, they threw all their masters out." I just went through the garbage, and I took the masters.
Wow.
When Record Plant in New York closed, the people who bought it they had a huge storage right in the back of the Record Plant. They had a huge storage facility, and record labels were notified that their tapes were there. They took them and put them in a storage facility in Jersey, and for paying your portion of the cost of storing these tapes for a month or whatever, you got the tapes back. If you were, you know, they notified all the labels, different people showed up. I showed up perhaps 3 weeks into this, had notified them I was coming, and took the tapes. And it was mostly Motown. There was a couple of good Stevie Wonders there, in fact. And we took the tapes, you know, had the tape shipped back to us, paid the freight. But there were piles and piles of tapes by labels who hadn't shown up. And they were only keeping them for X amount of time because they weren't going to spend the money. So this was not that long ago. This is not maybe a decade ago at the most. But what we do as far as, we obviously consider what we do now state of the art for the moment. And now with DSD and with other formats that we back up on, we try to preserve everything. I mean, I'm doing a project right now of a deluxe edition, as we call them, which is two CD versions of albums that would actually fit on one, and the second CD is usually alternate takes and other mixes and things like that. And I'm doing one of Who's first album, My Generation, and we mixed it down from three tracks with the original producer, and we're back. We did. During the session, we copied everything right straight onto DSD, and we're preparing for the next generation, and I think we're going to be doing more and more of that as SACD starts to hopefully takes hold, or DVDA or whatever the format's going to be. But I think we're more aware of that and getting things to the higher resolution as fast as possible at this point.
And so, are you systematically preserving everything in the vault?
No. No, we are not systematically preserving everything in the vault. But because of the nature of the depth of reissue programs nowadays, especially the one that we're involved in, so much more is being preserved at that level. And over the last two decades, since the CD revolution started, so much has been preserved. Now, it's not necessarily it's been preserved on 1610 and 1630, but hopefully it will go to the next level as we go in. But the reissue programs now are so central to the profit-making capabilities of record companies that, one of our labels, I was informed by my boss, we actually gave them 81% of their profit last year for their reissues. So that we're such a central part of that I don't see this process slowing down. It will get more modern, because that's what sells, but at the same time, the process will not slow down.
So do you think a bigger chunk of the label's inventory is going to be of reissues as opposed to new recordings?
Well, I think it's already that way. I think it's already that way. I think the new recording process actually slowed down, I think, a little bit. There's not as many new recordings being put out. It's very expensive. Mm-hmm. And I think the reissues, if you look at, we have a phone book size release book that comes out every couple of weeks, and the reissues from my side of the coin, from classics, from jazz, probably are greater than, I'd say, 60-70% of that book every week, or a subsidiary label who's doing reissues.
so more and more preservation will occur.
I think so. I think we have too much of a history of music. And if we do, if a new format does come in, hopefully it'll spark that whole process all over again.
Mm-hmm. Ralph, I know that you brought some examples with you of some of the preservation work that you've done.
Mm-hmm. If we have a remote controller, yeah. I can hit it.
Yeah, just give us the cue.
You can play the very first song that's on that CD if somebody has control of it.
Yeah, Barbara's going to play it back here.
Okay, and now you can go to number three. That was before you hit play on number three, that particular recording was done in the 50s, and the only remaining copy of that recording was on a cassette. And that particular cassette was then taken to Westlake Audio in Los Angeles, and we ran it through the SADE system using a Cedar software and did a number of different things to it. I'm not completely familiar with SADE to where I could talk about all the different programs that they offer with D-Thump and D-Click, and they have a number of different ways to do things. So if you can hit number three, you can hear what we're able to do now. So do one and then do three one more time. Play one again. Go to three. Okay, thank you. So that gave you an opportunity to hear how we were able to give that new life. In other words, that particular song, unfortunately, only existed on cassette. Now we do have a digital copy of the cassette that we've been able to alter by taking a lot of the hiss and things like that out of it. Further down in the song, we had some errors that we were able to correct also, with much more severe damage that was done to the cassette, to where it actually shifts from stereo to mono just from damage. So we were able to recreate the past completely and keep it in the stereo, keep the stereo imagery without over getting too creative with it, trying to keep it in its original form. Sony has come out with a format that's called DSD, which was actually intended to be a archiving format. And DSD is Direct Stream Digital. And it's an algorithm that's extremely challenging for the digital world. It's 1 bit, 28 megahertz, I believe, or something like that. It's 64 times 44.1. So it's 28 billion or something like that. Basically, when you hear 16-bit or 24-bit, 96K, or any of those different numbers that you hear, what they're trying to do, the mathematicians and the people who come up with these things, whether they're in Silicon Valley or wherever they reside, they're trying to come up with a way to use digital knowledge or digital information to recreate a sine wave. And the last part of the equation, if it's 16-bit, which all the CDs are still, and we're, as an industry, fighting to try to get the manufacturers to retool and go to 24-bit, when it's 16-bit 44.1, take for instance, that 44.1 is 44 stair steps. We don't have a board or anything for me to draw it on, but a sine wave is an arc. And each one of those, when you hear 44.1 or 48 or 96 or 88 or anything like that, that's 88 different cuts or digital samples that it takes in a sine wave. And each one of those cuts takes out a piece of the music. It does it really quickly, so quickly that most of us, especially the record buying public, which is 13 to 25, they could really care less. But it's important to us as archivists and purists to some degree to be able to come up with a way to reproduce the original sound as close to the way that the artists and the producer and the people who cared about the music as we can. And Sony with their DSD system has come very, very close. The stair steps are so far and few between that it literally is giving us an organic approach or organic reproduction in a digital domain. So it's exciting. I know you guys are excited about it also.
Yes, we are. The DSD it has its own sound though too. It's like
true.
It's every format has its own sound. It modifies you once you lay the music down, no matter what the sampling rate, no matter, it's still going to have its own sound. I just came through with that. We mixed some of the same songs to analog, and we mixed some straight to DSD, the same songs, and it was interesting because the DSD, some of the songs that need a little more brightness, the DSD was better for it. And some of the songs that needed, well, maybe a little more bottom, it was better to go analog, a little more warmth. The analog still was superior.
You know, it's interesting you said that because when we've done different tests within our industry, when we do what's known as the double blind test, where we'll have somebody who is completely unaware of which media is playing, they still pick analog. And there's something about the nature of the medium itself, and it's probably because it is so close to who we are. We're energy, and when we record something on analog tape, and that magnetic energy is put on that tape, and not to get too metaphysical about it, but there's something unique about the analog reproduction of music opposed to digital. No matter how good we get it, it's still something lacking. So I wish that we were able to come up with a way to make the analog machines and things of that ilk do much better, have a longer life expectancy and things of that nature, because it is a wonderful way to reproduce music. It's just so volatile, and as tapes sit up, they start losing some of the energy, and it is what it is. But the one good thing about analog tape and storing music on tape is that we do know for fact that a tape will play if stored properly 35 to 40 years from now, and actually even longer. It just depends upon how you maintain that tape.
Actually, interestingly, I had a situation where I was doing the Lynyrd Skynyrd box set, and I went down to Florida because I was told that in one of the deceased members' houses, that it was being kept by his daughter, they had tapes. They found tapes. So I was going to go down there and see what they had. And I went under a stairwell, which is where they had the tapes. This is in Jacksonville, Florida, you know, the number one the champions of humidity. And I went, and it was an unair-conditioned, old house, great old house, actually, but an unair-conditioned, great old house. And I go in this stairwell and open it up, and there's stacks of tapes. And most of it was backups for some of the multitracks, just their seconds for the multitracks, and safeties. So then, but I found one tape, and it was a demo reel. So, and I had never seen the demo reel, this reel before, and this had been stored there since the 70s. And this is probably 1990. So it's in an unair-conditioned area, humid. I took it back. It wouldn't even play on my machine. wouldn't play. On my Tascam, I just, wouldn't play. So I sent it down to the vault, though, to hold on to it. You know, I didn't want to bake. I didn't have any use for it at the moment. Didn't really want to deal with it. It did have one song on it that was a relatively common song. And the next time I asked my vault to send up the masters for that song, they sent me everything, which is what they're supposed to do, and then sort through it and pick out the right tapes. And they included this. And just for, I don't know, some sort of cliche. So for some reason, I decided to put the tape on to see if what the heck. It was in there about a year in the vault. This is the state-of-the-art vault. It played. So, you know, analog tape's amazing is what I guess it's just no matter what we do, too. Although I do say that one of the things, when we mixed it, we missed one particular track which needed brightness. And it was an old, this is 65 recording. It needed brightness, and we mixed it the DSD. The DSD sounded better than the analog.
Yep.
Which was kind of interesting, I thought.
Yeah. You know, this has always been a challenge for me and some of my other colleagues that I deal with constantly, and we have these conversations, technical talks and things of that nature, especially at the Recording Academy within the producer and engineers wing, where the Recording Academy is done a great thing, and that is to give producers and engineers an opportunity to talk about these things. And we all have agreed in saying that we love analog and we do not want to be responsible for holding back progress, though. So if we can continue on our digital quest to make it better and to make it better and to make it better, then we're going in the right direction. But until then, you know, analog for long-term storage and reproduction safety is still probably the safest bet, because unfortunately the digital world is a business, and if you can come out with something like Sony had the mini disc, and it was a great idea, and it didn't do as well as they thought, but initially they really pushed it, and they're on to something else, if you follow what I'm saying. So I think we run the risk sometimes if we can't come up with the standard to where we're going to keep changing formats, and when we feel really safe and secure and warm and fuzzy about something, then somebody comes up with a better way to do it and remarkets something else that is not compatible with what we believed. I know at Wonderland, part of my responsibility is to maintain the machines that Mr. Wonder has bought over the years, and I have Sony product from the very beginning of digital, all the way back to the PCM1. PCM1, I have three of those. I have from the PCM1, we went to the PCM701. PCM701 and PCM1 will not play one another's formats. From 701, we went to F1. From F1, we went to PCM10. And each one of these formats, we were told that this was it. This is gonna be the one. And we keep, this becomes a process. And fortunately for Mr. Wonder, he's able to purchase these machines and hold on to them. We have a 40,000 square foot warehouse with all these machines and over 800 devices with keys on them and that type of thing. But we've seen Sony come with the 3324, the 3348, 3348 HD. We've seen the 3M Digital. We've seen the Mitsubishi X80, X800, X850, X880. And it's just really, it's not the manufacturer's fault, but at some point we have to all agree on a format so that we can, as lovers of music, and see, I'm really passionate about this, and I understand that music, whether it's this gentleman's songs, and this guy is a virtuoso, this is Stanley Clark, he's a 6'4" bassist and celloist who has the hand speed of a flamenco guitar player at that. And for his work to be out on the front line of somebody's home really is just, it is what it is. But music in this form is capturing a moment in time in that gentleman's life where he performed something that will never be the same again. And he's a magnificent musician. And if you put a chart in front of him, he will never play that music twice the same way, even when he's reading the music and doing his absolute best to perform it the same way each time. It just can't happen. And when we capture life like that in this form, it's really valuable. So we really need to try to come up with a way that we can come up with a standard or a format that we can all agree to. Well, not all of us, but the majority of us can agree to where we have some kind of safety so that we can start putting our products on, our tapes on this format, and know that we're going to stick with it and hold to it.
Actually, that multi-formatting business that happened in the 80s especially,
yeah,
with digital is a bane of my existence. There's a guy named Steve Earle, who's sort of a country rocker, very bright, sort of an extension of Dylan into the modern age. And he was produced in our Nashville office, MCA's Nashville division, and every record he made was on a different digital format. And most of those formats are long forgotten. And so when I went back to do a compilation, we had to go out and find these formats. And it was not easy, actually, at this point.
Yeah, it's hard.
And it has been, because you either go back to that original or you use the 1610, which is terrible, of course. And, this has happened, unfortunately. There's Steely Dan stored theirs on Scotch format, that there's like two machines left in the United States or something like that. It's a very... reissuing the 80s is a very difficult task because of the beginnings of that, especially the beginning of I think it's slowed down a little bit over time, but the beginnings of digital are will haunt us for years to come.
We just have a few minutes left. I wanted to just save a couple of minutes for questions if anyone has.
From my perspective, the answer is yes. It's very valuable.
Yeah, say it again.
I just was asking these guys about metadata and whether they're keeping track of production notes and whether they found it valuable to have metadata from the past.
Did everyone hear that? It's about metadata. The question was about metadata, and do the labels find it useful, and do they track metadata, and is this something that they feel is important?
Any data is important to us.
Absolutely. I agree, and with my assistants and the gentleman that I work with throughout town when we leave our facility, I always make sure that they document every little thing that I do, including the distance that Stevie was from the microphone and things of that nature. And in that particular case, that's something that I tell them. I make sure that we stick to all the same things that we always do. That way we have a consistent way of recreating it later on, and then, yeah, for later on in the future.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually visited Amy's place 11 years ago.
Okay.
Okay, we'll talk later. I have a story. It doesn't have to do with this company, but there's a certain company in Hollywood and Vine Street. We're talking about metadata, which decided in several instances when they're moving or throw their paperwork away. Okay, if you took the tape out of that box, threw the box away, how would you know it was on there? So I'm not talking about sound so much because that's what you all deal with. What about the situation with paperwork? Any kind of paperwork helps you situate a session in time, who was playing, where it was done, how it was done. What's the attitude towards both of you all on paperwork? I did hear some mention of that already. And the industry's idea about what you keep and what you throw away.
Again, I think over time that's improved greatly. Going back to our predecessor labels, it's so spotty and so hit and miss, it's ridiculous. But I just go back to the CD revolution and how it pointed out to everyone the value of keeping such data, keeping tapes, keeping everything in order. And production departments increased in size. And they're primarily the ones who are responsible for keeping that kind of data on current recordings. And I know that it improved in the time that I've been doing this.
I think that the one area that we probably don't have that much control of, and it's actually becoming a really important part of the music business from a marketing and monetary standpoint, is the garage music, or the music that's being done in the Pro Tools domain, in the bedroom, and in the cousin's garage type of thing, and it becomes a mega one-hit wonder type of thing. We don't have any control over that as industry, because in some cases it is what it is. It was a great idea. Some guys got together and they were all able to come to what they've got, and unfortunately, they're not archiving and they're not thinking about the moment so that we could recreate it or have a rough idea of what they did at that time to do it, which is important.
But if they get involved with a major label, usually the major label insists on getting as much information out of them for legal purposes, if nothing else.
Especially when there's musicians involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a series of engineers in two facilities in the East Coast and the West Coast that are pretty adept at dealing with playback problems. That's mine. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, as far as pre-tape goes, I go outside. For pre-tape, I have a gentleman by the name of Stephen Lasker, who's in Venice, California, and I use him for my pre-tape work. But for tape work, we have our own facilities are more than comparable.
Right. And in my case, I'm not sure if you're talking about the baking process or fungus growing on a tape or something like that. And by the way, I have to mention that if you do run across a tape that that you see fungus growing on, don't even play around with it, because that fungus, you have to remember, fungus is a plant-like organism, and once it's in your lungs, it will continue to grow. I know it sounds kind of hocus pocus, but we just saw Ed McMahon with a big lawsuit about that. Fungus grows on these tapes, and it is what it is, so be cautious of that. With baking a tape, that's something that it's a very delicate art, and you should really consult with somebody who's done it more than once. In my particular case, I have 12 Weber electric ovens that we utilize. I preheat those ovens to 120 degrees, and I bake the tape for 8 hours. Baking, once again, is a very, very, very dangerous process, and you should never do it unless you have had experience doing it, because it is what it is. And in that particular case, you do only have one play. MTEC has quite a bit of information online on their webpage about baking tape and things of that nature. When you run across an old tape, and if it's not falling apart, once again, use my particular rule, which is one play. Play it once, record it to another analog tape, and record it into the digital domain, and manipulate it from there. If that tape snaps or breaks or something like that, put it back together. If it's quarter inch, use an editing block. Do not just put it across the table and slap some tape on it. There's a way to look at the tape, and we're unfortunately out of time. I was going to take one of the hubs apart which can kind of give you an idea if you're going to run into a problem. If the tape is really old, you have to be careful with the modern tape machine because the modern tape machines have a lot of torque and they'll pull them right apart. When Marvin Gaye died, we pulled out the tapes when I was at Motown Hitsville as a staff engineer, and we blew up two or three before we said we better get out the old Ampex machines. So that's something that you want to be very careful about when you have a tape that looks like it's volatile.
Probably have one more question. Yeah.
As far as recreating original recordings, original stereo mixes, we just try to recreate them. If there's no notes, we just have to use our ears, really. Use an engineer. I use a series of engineers who are especially good at matching up sounds, and I like to think I know something about it. And we try to just match it as best as possible. And many of them don't. Many reels do not have that kind of information.
Yeah. And as far as the Dolby stuff goes, you have to try to rent it. And if you can't rent it, then you play it back with the standard alignment and you make adjustments on the copy that you've made. If it's lacking high end, you add some high end. I know what you're saying, but unfortunately that's just especially the telecom stuff. That's I don't know of anyone who even has one of those processors anymore. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's all we have time for. We're running late, but thank you very much.